This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Happiness Equation. Want nothing plus do anything equals have everything. This is the author, Neil Pasricha. Welcome to The Happiness Equation. I'm so excited to share this book with you, and I want to just spend a second up front telling you about the structure of the book. Essentially, the book is broken into three big sections. Want nothing, do anything, and have everything. Each of those three sections contains three secrets, meaning the book contains nine secrets total. It's these nine secrets that I'm really excited to share with you now. Three ways to get the most out of this audiobook. Number three, agree to disagree. You will not agree with all nine secrets the first time you hear them. That's okay. Expect to disagree. But remember, you have the power to slowly let new ideas into your brain whenever you like. 100 years before neuroplasticity became a buzzword, American philosopher William James said, "Plasticity, in the wide sense of the word, means the possession of a structure weak enough to yield to an influence, but strong enough not to yield all at once." Number two, change your scenery. Listening to this book in one sitting is fine, but if you change your scenery, you'll get more out of it. A chapter in the buzzing airport, a chapter at the beach, a chapter in bed before flicking off your lamp. Our brains are stimulated by different air, smells, and sounds. Everywhere you listen to the book, you'll get something different from it, and you'll more easily recall the lessons. Number one, create a 7-day challenge. Anytime you hear an idea in this book that you want to try, give yourself a 7-day challenge. Write down every day in your calendar for 7 days, do X, and then try to do it. If you can do it for 7 days, you just proved you could do it for 7 days. Then you can do it for another 7 days. Then it becomes a habit. Aristotle said, "We are what we repeatedly do." Excellence, then, is not an act, but a habit. Author's note. I have spent more than a decade developing leaders. I have had incredible experiences speaking about leadership to hundreds of thousands of people around the world, eating dinner with royal families in the Middle East, sharing stages with Harvard deans, and consulting on leadership to organizations like Audi, Viacom, and GE. I have worked as director of leadership development at Walmart, interviewed billionaires, and worked directly for two CEOs at the world's largest company. But after years successfully helping people lead teams, lead businesses, and lead organizations, something slowly dawned on me. Hardly anyone was happy. Every conference lunch was filled with conversations about struggling to find balance, feeling too busy, and keeping up with others. So many leaders said they didn't have space in their lives, were stressed about time and money, and felt burdened with endless decisions and conflicting advice. Even the greatest leaders in the world, even billionaires, even Fortune 500 CEOs, were all plagued with dramatic crises on a daily basis. Fiery cauldrons of stress were bubbling in their heads and stomachs. I also realized I wasn't happy myself. I was searching for simple models to decide what to do, searching for structure to relieve stress, and searching for guidelines to steer me through tough decisions, constantly bogging me down. I thought about all the times I felt guilty not getting work done, burned out after a crazy week, or struggling in messy mental states for days, navigating tough choices. Looking back, I can't believe how much time I wasted. Being happier is the biggest challenge you face every single day at work. Same if you're a stay-at-home mom, studying through school, or traveling abroad. teaching and training your brain to stay positively focused while navigating the bumps of life is something we're not taught at school. I mean, have you ever taken a course called How to Be Happier? For the past few years, I have led workshops every summer with high school students who are brought together for the entire month of July for a world-class enrichment camp. These students have the highest grades in their schools, participate in the most clubs and teams, and are all destined for Ivy Leagues. They love the program because they get to meet and spend time with people like them. I do the workshops because I was lucky enough to attend when I was in high school. What started organically with no notes and no slides has slowly evolved into a talk I give called 9 Secrets to a Happier Life. And at the end of my talk, I open up to questions. I am always surprised by what is asked. The students don't have questions about getting better grades, getting into the best schools, or landing the highest paid jobs. They know they can do all that. Everything they ask comes from a desire to be happier. How much money do I need to retire? What's the best way to handle criticism? How do I get more done with less stress? How do I find my true passion? How can I cure my anxiety? What's the best way to achieve more inside and outside work? What do I do when everyone gives me different advice? How can I become a more positive person? The sessions are illuminating because they show how some of the smartest kids around don't care about developing brain power or technical smarts. They want contentment, freedom, and happiness. They want to want nothing, do anything, and have everything. They just want to live happier lives. So don't you think every college, university, and library would be full of courses and advice on how we can become happier? On how we can make decisions that spur ourselves into positive action every day? When I asked a hospitality CEO if he knew a book, model, or website that actually helped people navigate and simplify their most challenging decisions so they can live with contentment, freedom, and happiness, he said, "That book doesn't exist. It would be like asking every high-powered executive, successful person, and positive leader to distill all the personal mental models they've created over their lives into one book. Nobody has ever done it." I know this is true because I've been searching for a practical book with real frameworks on leading myself to happiness for years. I wanted something beyond stories about generals, parables about penguins, and research studies with data pointing any which way. I wanted real. I wanted practical. I wanted clear. I wanted an action book that I could use every day. This is that book. Section 1. Want nothing. Lao Tzu said, "Be content with what you have. Rejoice in the way things are. When you realize there is nothing lacking, the whole world belongs to you." Seneca said, "True happiness is to enjoy the present without anxious dependence upon the future, not to amuse ourselves with either hopes or fears, but to rest satisfied with what we have, which is sufficient, for he that is so wants nothing. The greatest blessings of mankind are within us and within our reach. A wise man is content with his lot, whatever it may be, without wishing for what he has not." And Stephen Wright said, "You can't have everything. Where would you put it?" Secret number 1. The first thing you must do before you can be happy. Chapter 1. 6 words that will forever change how you see happiness. Let's start off with some bad news. The happiness model we're taught from a young age is actually completely backward. We think we work hard in order to achieve big success, and then we're happy. We think the scribble goes like this. You do great work, then you have a big success, then you be happy. You study hard, then you get straight A's, then you be happy. You interview lots, then you get a great job, then you be happy. You work overtime, then you get promoted, then you be happy. But it doesn't work like that in real life. That model is broken. We do great work. We have a big success. But instead of being happy, we just set new goals. Now we study for the next job, the next degree, the next promotion. Why stop at a college degree when you can get a master's? Why stop at director when you can be VP? Why stop at one house when you can have two? We never get to happiness. It keeps getting pushed further and further away. What happens when we snap "be happy" off the end of this scribble and stick it on the beginning? Then these important six words look like this. First, you be happy. Then you do great work. Then you have a big success. Now everything changes. Everything changes. If we start with being happy, then we feel great. We look great. We exercise. We connect. What happens? We end up doing great work because we feel great doing it. What does great work lead to? Big success. Massive feelings of accomplishment and the resulting degrees, promotions, and phone calls from your mom telling you she's proud of you. Harvard Business Review reports that happy people are 31% more productive, have 37% higher sales, and are 3 times more creative than their counterparts. So what's the first thing you must do before you can be happy? Be happy. Be happy first. Being happy opens up your learning centers. Your brain will light up like Manhattan skyscrapers at dusk, sparkle like diamonds under jewelry store lights, glow like stars in the black sky above a farmer's field. American philosopher William James said, "The greatest discovery of any generation is that a human being can alter his life by altering his attitude." The Happiness Advantage author Sean Acor says, "It's not necessarily the reality that shapes us, but the lens through which your brain views the world that shapes our reality." And William Shakespeare says, "For there is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so." Chapter 2. The single biggest reason it's so hard to be happy. Shakespeare says, "For there is nothing either good or bad, but thinking makes it so." But if it's just thinking, plain thinking, why can't we think ourselves into a good mood whenever we want? Seems like we should just be able to flip a mental switch. But we all know it's not that easy. Sometimes our brains get focused on negative things. We can't stop. I do this all the time. And you want to know a secret? Everybody does. Every single person gets stuck focusing on the negative sometimes. I've spoken on stages with the best-known motivational speakers, Fortune 500 CEOs, and political leaders from around the world. Do you know what they're all doing backstage? Freaking out, sweating, thinking something might go wrong. We all have negative self-talk. There's no such thing as an eternal optimist. There are people who feel optimistic, but those people have negative self-talk too. And that's okay. The problem isn't that we have negative thoughts in our brain. The problem is we think we shouldn't have negative thoughts. But why do our brains focus on negative things? Once we understand this, we can learn how much we can control and make conscious efforts to be happy using proven techniques. This is one of the most important things I can share with you. Why is it so hard to be happy? Because life was mostly short, brutal, and highly competitive over the 200,000 years our species has existed on this planet. And our brains are trained for this short, brutal, and highly competitive world. How short, brutal, and highly competitive was it? Let's do a quick experiment. Stop, close your eyes, and picture the last time you felt completely alone in the middle of nowhere. Was it camping in the mountains when you walked away from the fire and stood on the jagged edge of a mirrory lake? Was it a misty waterfall you found on a field trip when your classmates disappeared and all you could hear was the wind rustling the leaves in the forest canopy? Was it jogging at sunrise on a sandy beach when you curled around the coastline and suddenly couldn't see anyone for miles in any direction? Picture yourself back in that scene. Now mentally erase from our planet all of the following. Toilets, sinks, showers, running water, computers, phones, internet, beds, chairs, roads, bikes, cars, planes, boats, books, paper, pencils, pens, hospitals, doctors, medicines, tools, grocery stores, fridges, freezers, farms, stoves, microwaves, shirts, sweaters, jackets, pants, socks, shoes, and underwear. You are now standing alone in the middle of the planet with none of those things. Take your phone out of your pocket and toss it away. Take your shoes and shirt off too, because they don't exist. Take everything off. You are completely naked with nothing around. None of those things exist, and none of them will begin to exist before the end of your life. Now close your eyes. Picture yourself there and remember that 99% of our history was living in this world. 99% of our history was with a lifespan of 30 years. 99% of our history was with brains constantly battling for survival. Life was short, brutal, and highly competitive, and we have the same brains now that we've had throughout our history. Were we happy back then? The better question is, did we have time to be happy? David Kane, author of several books and the website Raptitude, Getting Better at Being Human, describes this exact situation. He wrote, if one of our ancestors ever actually became happy with his possessions, with his social standing, or with what he had accomplished in life, he would suddenly be in a particular kind of danger. There was no cradle of civilization to depend on if something went wrong. So survival required us to make our own safety nets. Having enough could never feel like enough, or else we'd become complacent, leaving us vulnerable to predators, competitors, and bad luck. Lasting happiness was too risky. He continued, this instinctive need for what we don't yet have creates in us a persistent state of dissatisfaction. Without it, our ancestors would always be only one failed hunting session away from starvation. This simple, ruthless script is programmed to drive survival at all costs. It works exceedingly well for this purpose, but it leaves us feeling stress and unpleasantness much of the time. Unhappiness is nature's way of keeping people on their toes. It's a crude system, but it has worked for thousands of years. We have the same brains we've always had through this short, brutal, and highly competitive time in our history. Our brains didn't just suddenly change when we got printing presses, airplanes, and the internet. How have our brains been programmed? Our species first appeared 180,000 years ago. Back then, it was pretty clear. We thought, I need food and safety. If I don't, I'll die. How about 170,000 years ago? Or 160,000 years ago? It was the same. I need food and safety. If I don't, I'll die. How about 10,000 years ago? I need food and safety. If I don't, I'll die. How about 5,000 years ago? I need food and safety. If I don't, I'll die. How about 1,000 years ago? Not that long. I need food and safety. If I don't, I'll die. And how about today? I need happiness. And if I don't, I'll die. What did all of that fear do? It drove our survival. We survived at all costs. We were paranoid. We were fighters. We were ruthless. We were brutal. We were murderous. And because of it, we got here. And because of it, we took over the planet. And because of it, we have everything in the world. So that begs the question, is that fear still programmed into our heads today? Chapter 3. The one thing your doctor, teacher, and Tom Hanks all have in common. Yes, that fear is still programmed into our heads. It's everywhere. It's between our ears. It's in our brains. Tom Hanks, one of the world's most successful actors, who earned millions with every movie and has scored 2 Academy Awards, said, "Some people go to bed at night thinking, that was a good day. I am one of those who worries and asks, how did I screw up today?" Andy Grove is the longtime Intel executive who helped transform the company into a multi-billion dollar success. He was believed by many to have helped drive the growth phase of Silicon Valley, was named Time's Man of the Year in 1997, and was idolized by Steve Jobs, according to Jobs' biography. How did he famously put it? Only the paranoid survive. Our brains still follow this paranoid model every day, and it is a recipe for unhappiness. Some call it medical student syndrome. That's a term Jerome K. Jerome first coined in his 1889 classic, 3 Men in a Boat. He wrote, "I remember going to the British Museum one day to read up the treatment for some slight ailment of which I had a touch. Hay fever, I fancy it was. I got down the book and read all I came to read, and then, in an unthinking moment, I idly turned the leaves and began to indolently study diseases, generally. I forget which was the first distemper I plunged into, some fearful, devastating scourge, I know. And, before I had glanced half down the list of premonitory symptoms, it was borne in upon me that I had fairly got it. I sat for a while, frozen with horror, and then, in the listlessness of despair, I again turned over the pages. I came to typhoid fever, read the symptoms, discovered that I had typhoid fever. Must have had it for months without knowing it. Wonder what else I had got. Turned up St. Vitus's dance. Found, as I expected, that I had that too. Began to get interested in my case and determined to sift it to the bottom. And so started alphabetically. Read up ague and learnt that I was sickening for it and that the acute stage would commence in about another fortnight." It's not just medical students. We've all been there. We scan the world for problems because that led to our survival. And our current design of the world only reinforces and grows these negative lens feelings. At your doctor's office, when you get lab results, the doctor says, "Your blood sugar is fine, your cholesterol is fine, but your iron is low." What do? You talk about getting your iron up. Eat steak. No work is done improving your blood sugar or your cholesterol. If cholesterol should be below 200 milligrams per deciliter and you're at 195, great. If you're 205, that's a problem. Doctors get paid when we're sick. Shouldn't we pay them when we're healthy? Retail store managers manage by exception by staring at morning reports, finding a number below average, and trying to bump it up. If that report says your traffic count is fine, basket size is fine, but checkout time is below average, what does the boss want? Faster checkouts. More cashiers. No work is done improving statistics that are already average. In the classroom, the teacher hands back test results and offers extra help to those below average. They have to pass. If not, the year is repeated. The system is drained. Friends all move ahead. What happens for the below average kids? Extra help at lunch. Tutoring sessions. Remedial tests. Why aren't students who get 100% offered any extra challenge? It's no different in the workplace. We get job evaluations showing how well we're doing. What happens if you're below expectations? Performance improvement plan, extra meetings with the boss, ship to training classes. What happens if you're doing well? 2% raise. Pat on the back. Rather than find good results and make them better, our brains do this. 1. Look for problem. 2. Find problem. 3. Improve problem. That's what our brains have been trained to do for 200,000 years. But because we scan the world for problems, sometimes that's all we see. Here's how New York Times bestselling author Kelly Oxford framed our medical student syndrome on Twitter. She wrote, WebMD is like a choose-your-own-adventure book where the ending is always cancer. So what do we do about it? Chapter 4. How much can we control? Aristotle said, happiness depends upon ourselves. Viktor Frankl wrote, everything can be taken from a man but one thing, the last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way. Walt Whitman wrote, keep your face always toward the sunshine, and the shadows will fall behind you. I love what Aristotle, Viktor Frankl, and Walt Whitman said, but how do you get there? Well, we now have scientific evidence of the importance of attitude and specific proven actions we can take to manage our attitude. When my wife Leslie turned 16, her grandmother gave her a brass-framed quote for her birthday. She hung it on her bedroom wall. She looked at it in the mornings before school, and it is still hanging in her old bedroom today. I have stopped to read it several times, and I'm going to share it with you now. Here is what the brass-framed quote says. Attitude. The longer I live, the more I realize the impact of attitude on life. Attitude, to me, is more important than facts. It is more important than the past, than education, than money, than circumstances, than failures, than successes, than what other people think or say or do. It is more important than appearance, giftedness, or skill. It will make or break a company, a church, a home, a friendship. The remarkable thing is we have a choice every day regarding the attitude we will embrace for that day. We cannot change our past. We cannot change the fact that people will act in a certain way. We cannot change the inevitable. The only thing we can do is plan on the one we have, and that is our attitude. I am convinced that life is 10% what happens and 90% how I react to it. And so it is with you. We are in charge of our attitudes. This quote about attitude, hung on my wife Leslie's old bedroom wall, was said by Charles Swindle, a Texas preacher who broadcast a show to more than 2,000 radio stations. And do you know what's amazing about this quote? The second last sentence. He wrote, I am convinced that life is 10% what happens and 90% how I react to it. Well, new research published in The How of Happiness by University of California psychology professor Sonia Lyubomirsky tells us exactly how much of our happiness is based on our life circumstances. And it is 10%. 10% of our happiness is what happens to us. So 90% of our happiness isn't based on what's happening in the world. It's based on how we see the world. What's included in the 90%? Our genetic predisposition and our intentional activities. Yes, intentional activities. This is big. Those are specific things we can do to improve our happiness. And they alone have 4 times the effect on our happiness than anything happening in our life. Let me put it another way. If I knew everything about your life circumstances, your job, your health, your marital status, your income, I could predict only 10% of your happiness. That's it. The remaining amount is not determined by your external world, but by the way your brain processes it. Chapter 5. 7 Ways to Be Happy Right Now. How do you be happy first? For this chapter, we look to the emerging field of positive psychology. What's that? It's not fluffy lollipop experiments. Professors of psychology Martin Seligman and Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi are called the fathers of positive psychology because of their passion for cold, hard facts. As they put it themselves in American Psychologist, psychology is not just a branch of medicine concerned with illness or health. It is much larger. It is about work, education, insight, love, growth, and play. And in this quest for what is best, positive psychology does not rely on wishful thinking, faith, self-deception, fads, or hand-waving. It tries to adapt what is best in the scientific method to the unique problems that human behavior presents to those who wish to understand it in all its complexity. Positive psychology is a new and growing field. I have sifted through hundreds of studies to find the big seven ways to train your brain to be happy. Many of these studies have been discussed in journals, conference keynotes, and research reports, but I've brought them together for you here. If you do any of these seven things for 2 straight weeks, you will feel happier. So what are the big seven? Well, I'm going to list them for you first, and then I'll talk about each one in detail. They are 3 walks, the 20-minute replay, random acts of kindness, a complete unplug, hit flow, 2-minute meditations, and 5 gratitudes. Now let's talk about each one briefly. 3 walks. Pennsylvania State researchers reported in the Journal of Sport and Exercise Psychology that the more physically active people are, the greater their general feelings of excitement and enthusiasm. Researcher Amanda Hyde reports, "We found that people who are more physically active have more pleasant activated feelings than people who are less active. And we also found that people have more pleasant activated feelings on days when they are more physically active than usual." It doesn't take much. 1/2 hour of brisk walking 3 times a week improves happiness. The American Psychosomatic Society published a study showing how Michael Babiak and a team of doctors found that 3 30-minute brisk walks or jogs even improve recovery from clinical depression. Yes, clinical depression. Results were stronger than studies using medication or studies using exercise and medication combined. Next is the 20-minute replay. Writing for 20 minutes about a positive experience dramatically improves happiness. Why? Because you actually relive the experience as you're writing it, and then relive it every time you read it. Your brain sends you back. There's no GPS system in your mind. In a University of Texas study called How Do I Love Thee? Let Me Count the Words, researchers Richard Slatcher and James Pennebaker had one member of a couple write about their relationship for 20 minutes, 3 times a day. Compared to the test group, the couple was more likely to engage in intimate dialogue afterward, and the relationship was more likely to last. What does the 20-minute replay do? It helps us remember things we like about people and experiences in our lives. Next up is random acts of kindness. Carrying out 5 random acts of kindness a week dramatically improves your happiness. We don't naturally think about paying for someone's coffee, mowing our neighbor's lawn, or writing a thank you note to our apartment building security guard at Christmas. But Sonia Lubomirsky, author of The How of Happiness, did a study asking Stanford students to perform 5 random acts of kindness over a week. Not surprisingly, they reported much higher happiness levels than the test group. Why? They felt good about themselves. People appreciated them. In his book, Flourish, Professor Martin Seligman says that we scientists have found that doing a kindness produces the single most reliable momentary increase in well-being of any exercise we have tested. Next up is a complete unplug. The richest, happiest, and most productive lives are characterized by the ability to fully engage in the challenge at hand, but also to disengage periodically and seek renewal. Say Jim Lohr and Tony Schwartz in The Power of Full Engagement. And a Kansas State University study found that complete downtime after work helps us recharge for the next day. Turning your phone off after dinner, not using the internet on vacation. There's a lot more to this, and we're going to chat about it in detail in secret number 6. Hit flow. Get into a groove. Be in the zone. Find your flow. However you characterize it, when you're completely absorbed with what you're doing, it means you're being challenged and demonstrating skill at the same time. Mihai Csikszentmihalyi describes this moment as being completely involved in an activity for its own sake. The ego falls away. Time flies. Every action, movement, and thought follows inevitably from the previous one, like playing jazz. Your whole being is involved, and you're using your skills to the utmost. 2-minute meditations. A research team from Massachusetts General Hospital looked at brain scans of people before and after they participated in a course on mindfulness meditation and published the results in Psychiatry Research. What happened? After the course, parts of the brain associated with compassion and self-awareness grew, while parts associated with stress shrank. Studies report that meditation can permanently rewire your brain to raise levels of happiness. And finally, 5 gratitudes. If you can be happy with simple things, then it will be simple to be happy. Find a book or a journal or start a website and write down 3 to 5 things you're grateful for from the past week. I wrote down 5 a week on 1000awesomethings.com. Some people write in a notebook by their bedside. Back in 2003, researchers Robert Emmons and Michael McCullough asked groups of students to write down 5 gratitudes, 5 hassles, or simply 5 events that happened over the past week for 10 straight weeks. Guess what happened? The students who wrote 5 gratitudes were happier and physically healthier. Charles Dickens put this well. Reflect upon your present blessings, of which every man has many, not your past misfortunes, of which all men have some. So those are the big 7. You know it's important to be happy first, and those are the 7 ways to get there. Remember, just like driving a car, throwing a football, or doing a headstand, you can learn to be happier. Chapter 6, A Final Lesson from the Convent. A few years ago, a group of researchers at the University of Kentucky stumbled upon pure academic gold. Cardboard boxes stashed away and full of handwritten autobiographies written by nuns as they joined U.S. convents in the 1930s and 40s. So the researchers read these autobiographies and began sorting them into piles based on how positive the attitude and emotion were in each one. There was a normal nun pile, and there was a happy nun pile, and the researchers used words from the autobiographies to put them into those different groups. Then what happened? Well, in present time, 70 years later, the researchers excitedly rubbed their hands together, squealed nerdy academic researcher squeals, and compared those dusty old autobiographies with how well the nuns were doing today. Now keep in mind, the best thing about studying nuns is that all the difficult, hard-to-control variables were controlled. None of them smoked, drank, had sex, got married, or had kids, ever. They even lived in the same cities, ate the same foods, and wore the same clothes. Who's doing a load of whites? Nobody, ever. Therefore, their positive attitude 70 years ago was the prime indicator of how long they lived. That's why this study is so powerful. And guess what the researchers found out? Revolutionary findings that sent academic circles buzzing. staggering takeaways about the power of starting with a positive lens in your life. They published the results and called them Positive Emotions in Early Life and Longevity, findings from the Nunn study. Here's what they found. First, the happiest nuns lived 10 years longer than the least happy nuns. Second, by age 80, the most happy group had lost only 25% of its population, whereas the least happy group had lost 60%. And finally, 54% of the most happy nuns reached the age of 94, compared to only 15% of the least happy nuns. The Nunn study shows an incredibly strong link between how happy you are today and how long you're going to live. And it's not just length either. Think of it. You will be happier through all those years. Happy people don't have the best of everything. They make the best of everything. Be happy first. Secret number two. Do this and criticism can't touch you. Chapter 1. The only goal you set that matters. Blog stats, 50,017 hits. Heart thumping, palm sweating, I sit back on my creaky wooden chair, stare at my blog, and grimace. Is this real? I click refresh, scrunch my face, and look at the screen again. Blog stats, 50,792 hits. 700 people visited my blog in the last 30 seconds, I think to myself. Only 4 weeks ago, I'd started writing 1000awesomethings.com, and after a few hundred visits, it looks like that day's post, number 980, Old Dangerous Playground Equipment, went viral while I was at work. My heart beats faster. I had one simple goal when I started writing 1000 Awesome Things. I wanted to try and write 1000 Awesome Things for 1000 days in a row. But after the first couple weeks writing about broccoli flour and potato chip crumbs, I started noticing the stats counter on the side of my page. It showed how many people had visited. 7, then 20, then dozens, then hundreds. I got hooked on watching the number climb. So I set a different goal for myself. I decided I wanted 50,000 hits. When number 980, Old Dangerous Playground Equipment, went viral a few weeks later, I had suddenly accomplished my goal. But then I told myself 50,000 was too small, too easy. It didn't mean much getting 50,000 hits. The big sites had 1 million. So that became my new goal, 1 million hits. I kept writing every day, adding links to email signatures and blog comments I left around the web. I got stickers printed and started handing them out. I wrote number 951, hearing a stranger fart in public. Number 933, the first scoop out of a jar of peanut butter. And number 909, bakery air. Flash forward a few months later, and I got to 1 million hits. I enjoyed the feeling for a couple days before realizing the best blogs don't just get 1 million hits. They get 10 million hits and get turned into books and movies. I had set my goal too low. 1 million hits wasn't worth anything. Nothing happened when you got 1 million hits. I needed to go big to get some real action. So I set a new goal, 10 million hits. For 6 months, I kept writing. After work every day, I got takeout and sat on my computer well into the night. I wrote the next post, responded to email, and started getting interviews with local radio and TV stations. I was even featured on the front page of the Toronto Star. I wrote number 874, the 5-second rule, number 858, the other side of the pillow, and number 824, finding the TV remote after looking forever. 9 months after I started my blog, I suddenly reached 10 million hits, won 2 awards for best blog in the world, and was approached by literary agents to turn my blog into a book. Once I had a literary agent, I started researching the book industry. I learned that more than 300,000 books are published in the United States every single year, and well over a million books are published around the world each year. Suddenly it dawned on me, getting a book published was not very special. A million people did it every year. I looked at bestseller lists, and they only had 10 or 20 books on them. I calculated that only a few hundred books made bestseller lists each year, less than 0.01%. So I set a new goal. I wanted my book to be a bestseller. I wanted to be one of the 0.01%. The Globe and Mail published a bestseller list every weekend, and I started checking it. What did these books have in common? What made them great? What made them sell? So for the next year, I kept writing my blog every day, writing my book, and working on a book launch plan. My plan was to work with bloggers to prepare interviews and articles about my book while working with my publisher to line up radio, newspaper, and TV interviews, all to come out when the book hit shelves. Basically, the entire year after winning the awards, I was consumed with The Book of Awesome hitting the bestseller list. It was all I wanted, thought about, talked about. Then, the big day of publication finally came. I woke up early and started interview after interview. I posted a special entry called number 526, When Dreams Come True. My voice turned scratchy, bags under my eyes turned black, and I was sleeping 3 or 4 hours a night. And then, finally, the next Saturday morning, the newspaper came out and I hit number 2 on the bestseller list. It was a dream come true. I went to bed happy. I had achieved my goal. My publishers were excited too. Their joy said, keep pushing. I woke up the next morning and took a closer look at the bestseller list. My book was listed with a 1 beside it because it had been on the bestseller list for 1 week. I noticed other books were on the list for 20 or 30 weeks. Staying power. That was more important than being a one-hit wonder. I didn't want to go the rest of my life telling people my book was a bestseller for only 1 week. I suddenly realized that popping on the bestseller list was nice, but it was nowhere near my true goal. I wanted this book to be bigger, the New York Times bestseller list, a number 1 beside my name. Eventually, The Book of Awesome hit number 1 on the bestseller list and stayed there for 5 weeks, then 10 weeks, then 50 weeks, then 100 weeks. Foreign publishers translated the book into German, Korean, French, Dutch, and Portuguese. The Book of Awesome hit the New York Times bestseller list too. I was on the Today Show, The Early Show, CNN, and the BBC. The producers of The Office optioned TV rights to the book, and some big film producers optioned the movie rights too. I got another book deal, then another book deal, then another. And I had done it. I had finally reached my goal. I started smiling, tried to relax. A few days later, after working so hard for 3 years straight, lying in bed alone in my tiny apartment, getting 3 or 4 hours of sleep, eating takeout for every meal, developing black bags under my eyes, losing touch with so many friends, I suddenly had a realization. No matter how many external goals I achieved, I just kept setting more. I started realizing that external goals didn't help me become a better person. Only internal goals did. Chapter 2. What's the biggest problem with external goals? When I was stressing about my blog and watching hit counters, bestseller lists, and award nominations, I was using external motivators. I wasn't doing it for me. I was doing it for others. I lost my self-confidence because I started outsourcing it to signals outside my brain, which I couldn't always control. When those signals were positive, I was flying. Lots of emails, piles of comments, and bestseller list rankings lifted me up and kept me going. But when those signs were negative, even relatively negative, I was devastated. Critical comments, a nasty review, and the inevitable slipping off the bestseller list meant I was a loser. Chapter 3. four simple words that block all criticism. 1. Do. 2. It. 3. 4. 4. You. Do it for you. Those are the four words. Don't do it for others. It's hard to compete endlessly because there's always more to compete with when you get there. Remember, we will always be number 2 to 7 billion at everything in the world. And every level we go up has new peers, new benchmarks, new competitors. A CEO once told me, you always think the geniuses are at the next level. But the next level never ends unless you are literally the best in the entire world. What are the odds of that happening? Well, they are 1 in 7 billion. You have better chances of getting struck by lightning every single day of your life. Chapter 4. Why your dream job could be the worst job you ever have. Teddy Roosevelt famously said, "It's not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles, or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes short again and again, because there is no effort without error and shortcoming. But who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who neither know victory nor defeat." It's not the critic who counts. But what motivates that man in the arena? Why is he working so hard? First, remember there are two types of motivation, intrinsic and extrinsic. Intrinsic is internal. You're doing it because you want to. Extrinsic is external. You're doing it because you get something for it. Guess which gets better performance? Studies show that when we begin to value the rewards we get for doing a task, we lose our inherent interest in doing the task. Like, we literally lose interest, as in the interest we have becomes truly lost in our minds, hidden away from our own brains, as the shiny external reward sits front and center and becomes the new object of our desire. While at Brandeis University, Dr. Teresa Amabile performed experiments on elementary school and college students and asked groups to make silly collages and invent stories for them. Some were told they were getting rewards for their work, and some were not. What happened? Based on independent judges who didn't know who was getting paid, the least creative projects by far were done by students who were promised rewards for their work. Dr. Amabile said, "It may be that commissioned work will in general be less creative than work that is done out of pure interest." Makes sense. When you're not doing it for you, you're not doing a good job. It's not just that getting rewards hurts quality either. In another study, 72 creative writers at Brandeis and Boston universities were split into three groups of 24 creative writers each and asked to write poetry. Some were given extrinsic reasons for doing so. Impressing teachers, making money, getting into fancy grad schools. Others were given a list of intrinsic reasons for writing haiku, enjoying the feeling of expressing themselves, the fun of playing with words. And the third group wasn't given any reasons at all. On the sidelines, Dr. Amabile put together a group of a dozen poet judges, mixed up all the poems, and had the judges evaluate the work. By far and away, the lowest quality poems were from those who had the list of extrinsic motivators for doing so. James Garbarino, former president of the Erickson Institute for Advanced Study in Child Development, was curious about this phenomenon. He studied 5th and 6th grade girls hired to tutor younger children. Some of the tutors were offered free movie tickets for doing a good job. Some weren't. What happened? The girls offered free movie tickets took longer to communicate ideas, got frustrated more easily, and did a worse job in the end than the girls who were given nothing except the feeling of helping someone else. I was surprised by the studies, but they made sense to me. I remember writing articles for the Golden Words comedy newspaper at Queen's University every Sunday night for 4 straight years while in college. I didn't get paid a cent, but I loved every minute because I got to hang out with a group of really funny people writing articles that made us all laugh. I loved it so much that I took a job working at a New York City comedy writing startup in my last summer at college. I rented an apartment on the Lower East Side and started working in a Brooklyn loft with writers from The Simpsons and Saturday Night Live. Wow, I remember thinking, I can't believe I'm getting paid to do what I love. It was the hardest job of my life. Instead of having creative freedom to write whatever I wanted, I had to write 800 words about the bright side of getting dumped by 5 p.m. for a client like Cosmopolitan Magazine. Instead of joking with friends naturally, finding chemistry with certain people, I was scheduled to write with others. Eventually, my interest in comedy writing faded and faded and faded, and I decided I would never do it for money again. When I started writing 1,000 Awesome Things, I said I'd never put ads on the website. I would have liked the beer money, but I knew the ads would feel like work to me. I might start writing an article to get more views on an ad, and I would be spending time checking invoices, looking at payment transfers. It would take away, or just hide, my reasons for writing in the first place. I was smart about that, but not smart enough to ignore the other extrinsic motivators that kept showing up. Stat counters, website awards, bestseller lists. It was all so visible, so measurable, and so tempting. I started looking into this whole extrinsic motivators kill intrinsic motivators phenomenon, and I kept finding studies showing this to be true. Professor Edward Deci of the University of Rochester had students try to solve a puzzle. Some were told they were competing with other students, and some were not. Guess what happened? The students told they were competing with others simply stopped working once the other kids finished their puzzle, believing themselves to be out of the race. They ran out of reasons to do the puzzle in the first place. But those who weren't told they were competing with others kept going once their peers finished. When you don't feel like you're competing with others, you compete only with yourself. You do it for you. And you do more, go further, and perform better. Want to hear an old joke? An old man enjoyed sitting on his front porch every day until the elementary school bell rang and neighborhood kids walking past his porch stopped to taunt him from the sidewalk. Finally, the old man came up with a plan. He offered the children $1 each if they'd return the next day and yell their insults. They were excited, so they returned, yelled their insults, and he paid each of them $1. He then said he'd like them to come back the next day and yell their insults, but he could only pay them 25 cents. So they returned, yelled their insults, and he paid them $0.25 each. Before they left, he said that he could only afford to pay them a penny on Wednesday. Forget it, they said. That's not worth it. And they never bothered him again. Chapter 5. The 3 S's of Success. How can I be successful? I smiled at the eager 50-something woman beside me. We were sitting at table 1 at a banquet dinner for SHAD, a nonprofit for which I sit on the board of directors, as students paraded across the stage winning awards. Me being a director, she being a sponsor, we would be sitting a foot apart for the next 2 hours. The chairman of the board introduced us with a big grin and said, "Neil's a New York Times bestseller who sold over 1 million books. Nancy wants to be a writer. Enjoy." Now I was smiling at her bright and shiny face. She spent a few minutes telling me about the years she'd spent writing novels that she's never shown anybody. Then came the big question. "What's your secret to success?" she asked. I paused for a minute and thought about it. "Do you have a pen?" I asked, grabbing a napkin. "Let me show you a scribble." I drew what I called the success triangle, with the words sales, social, and self at each of the 3 points. "There are 3 S's of success," I started. I put them in the success triangle. It took me a really long time to figure this out. The first step is actually figuring out what kind of success you want. Each corner of the triangle has a different label. Let's talk about each one.